This summer, our family is driving to Florida from New York. If you've ever done that drive, it is a very long and strenuous trip from the island all the way down to the end of the panhandle. And I remember doing this one other time in my lifetime. I did it when my kids were a little bit younger. I had three kids under the age of 8 at the time. And we left very early on in the morning, and the minivan got up when it was dark outside and started to beat the traffic of the island in hopes to get out of the area before anything slowed us down. And we couldn't have been maybe about just before the GW Bridge when we've heard the first question come from the back of the car. Are we there yet? Now, as a parent, that's a little bit of a condescending and annoying question when you're on a 24-hour journey and you haven't gotten but 45 minutes into your journey. Right? There's a sense in which if you're the compassionate one in your family, you might very well say, well, you know, no, we're not there yet. We're not there yet. But when the car stops, that will be the indicator that we're there. And of course, the first time you stop for the bathroom or for lunch or whatever, everybody's just in a tizzy because, wait, you said you would be here. Or you can be a little bit more blunt, a little more direct, and say, hey, listen, guys, it was dark when we left. It'll be dark when we arrive. So why don't you just be quiet and stay in the back and don't talk anymore, right? You can be a little more direct. Like, I can't answer this question for the next 24 hours of this trip. Why? They want to know what to anticipate. They want to know what to expect. And all along the way, they see signs for Florida. They see the anticipation of crossing state after state, and they want to know when we will get there. When they get there, it'll be obvious, right? There will be signs for Florida with oranges and Mickey Mouse ears all over the place. They will know when they've arrived, but they want to know. Well, Daniel, in his time in exile, is also beginning to wonder when all of these things will end, when the exile will be over, when the kingdom of God will come, when everything will be established the way that God had foretold it would be. And so chapter 8 gives us a little bit of a short answer to this question of when will things end? When will we get to where we want to go? When will we reach the final destination? Now, if you remember from last week in chapter 7, we saw this vision that was very similar to a vision from chapter 2 that gave us a little bit of a look at history to see what was going to take place from the time of Daniel all the way until the time of Christ. And we see many evil forces that pop up and evil kings and empires that often oppose the people of God and at times even oppose God. And we see that ultimately that God is going to bring judgment through the Son of Man. He's going to come in. He's going to defeat these kingdoms. He's going to establish his kingdom forever. And he will have victory over evil. And he will share it with his people. He will share it with us. Even though we don't deserve it, he is going to bless us immensely with it. Well, chapter 8 has another vision, another opportunity for God to give a message to Daniel. Another chance to hear about what's going to happen in the future. And just like chapter 7, chapter 8 begins with a very important verse that tells us about when all this is happening. Because chapter 8 happens 3 years after chapter 7, but happens several years in between chapters 4 and chapter 5. It's not chronological. It's not giving us a time by time as we go through the book. It's jumping around a little bit here. And this one happens 3 years into the reign of Belshazzar. We also know that chapters 8 through 12 are no longer written in Aramaic. Chapter 7 was written in Aramaic. It was a letter, or it was a chapter that in a sense was intended for all the world because everybody would know Aramaic. But chapters 8 through 12 are written in Hebrew. It's intended primarily for the Jewish people. It's something for them to know about their future and about what their future holds and what things will look like. And so this morning, we're going to look at three things in chapter 8 together. First, we want to look at who and when this vision is about. Who it's about, when it will happen. What is God showing to Daniel? Secondly, we want to know why God gave Daniel this vision. That's very important. To know the whys helps us to know how to apply these things and what we're to do about it. And then finally, we want to know what you and I are to know and to do in light of this chapter, in light of this vision. Now, chapter 8 helps us by giving us some important information up front. In the third year, in verse 1, of the king of Belshazzar, a vision appeared to me, Daniel, after that which appeared to me at the first. I saw in the vision, and when I saw, I was in Susa, the citadel, which is in the province of Elam. I saw in the vision and was at the Ulai Canal. So here you have this reference to when it was written. We know it was written in between chapters 4 and chapter 5. And at this time, King Cyrus, who is beginning to raise up in power, he is the general of Persia, he'll soon be the king of Persia. About this time, he is beginning to raise up. And all the nations around him are beginning to wonder, what is going to happen with Persia? What are they going to do? We often can sort of wonder the same things about nations that are around us, right? What's China going to do next? What is Russia going to do? Everybody wants to know what's going to happen. And Babylon is so concerned about it that they actually begin to make a treaty or attempt to make a treaty with Egypt in hopes that they can somehow stop the conquest of the Persians into their part of the world. Everybody's nervous about what the Persians will do. Everybody's curious what it will look like. It also says here in verse 2 that Daniel, all of a sudden, is in a place called Susa, which is several hundreds of miles away from Babylon. Now, it's possible that Daniel went to sleep in Babylon in the courts of Belshazzar and woke up in the middle of this dream several hundred miles away. But it's more likely that he's there sort of spiritually, sort of symbolically. He's not really in Susa. He just, in his vision, it looks like he's there. Sometimes I have that, right? I'm in the middle of my dream, the middle of the night. I think that I'm at work. And then I wake up in a sweat because I realize, wait, I'm not at work. I'm late. I'm not where I'm supposed to be. Why? Because I think that I'm someplace that I'm not. Daniel has this vision that he's in Susa. I don't think he's actually in Susa. Because at the end of the chapter, he's back in Babylon. That's a lot of travel back and forth very, very quickly. But he has this vision that he's in Susa. And while in this vision, he has several things that he sees. And thankfully, Daniel not only gives us the vision, but he also is going to give us the interpretation of the vision. There's not a lot left for us to wonder about. In verse 15... Daniel says this, if we jump ahead. I, Daniel, had seen the vision. I sought to understand it. Behold, there stood before me one having the appearance of a man. I heard a man's voice between the banks of the Ulai, and it called Gabriel. Make this man understand the vision. So he came near where I stood. And when he came, I was frightened and fell on my face. But he said to me, "Oh, understand, O son of man, that the visions is for the time of the end." When he had spoken to me, I fell into a deep sleep with my face to the ground. But he touched me and made me stand up. And he said, "Behold, I will make known to you what shall be that the latter end of the indignation, for it refers to the appointed time of the end." This is one of the easiest prophecies to understand because Daniel, in the chapter, gives us every explanation for what he sees, beginning in verse 15. But I want you to notice, it's not Daniel's interpretation of what he sees. It's God's interpretation of what he's given to Daniel that he then gives through this angel named Gabriel. Now, we'll see Gabriel a lot later on in the Bible, but this is the first time we're introduced to him by name. And he comes to give the interpretation from God to Daniel about what these visions are. Now, there's a couple of things to consider before we jump into the vision itself. The first thing is that there will be implications for end time events, future from us, return of Jesus kind of events. There will be implications of those things in the text. But the text primarily is not talking about the future for us. It's talking about the future for Daniel, which is in the past for us. And we have to keep that in mind as we read it. It's not primarily talking about the end of the age. It's talking about the end of the vision. The end of what God is talking about. Second, the interpretation is specific about some things and vague about others. Now, some of you go, "Well, that is a genius thing to say, Brooke. It's specific and vague." But I say that because I want you to understand that not all things are given equal attention in the vision. And it's easy for us sometimes to zero in on things that God actually considers to be minor and to make them major. And to overlook the major things and to make them minor. And so we have to be able to distinguish, well, what's the focal point of the vision? And what are just some of the peripheral things of the vision that are important, but maybe not as important as the rest of the vision? And then finally, and maybe this is most important, we have to remember that Daniel only understood the vision because of Gabriel giving him the interpretation. There's a tendency among people to want to go beyond what Daniel says in this book and to make conclusions and interpretations that Gabriel did not give. And we have to be careful that we don't somehow suggest that we are smarter and wiser than Daniel and that we know more about the future than Gabriel, or that we say something that God never intended. Because there are a lot of people out there that say a lot of things about the future that don't do it based on Scripture, but do it based upon their own inclination, their own thought process, and it has nothing to do with what God is actually saying or doing. So the first thing is who is this vision about, and when does all this occur? Let's look at verse 3. I raised my eyes and saw, and behold, a ram standing on the bank of the canal. It had two horns, and both horns were high, but one was higher than the other. And the higher horn came up last. I saw the ram charging toward westward and northward and southward. No beast could stand before him. There was no one who could rescue him from his power. He did as he pleased and became great. Now, we start here with a ram that Daniel sees. Very complicated. It's charging, and no one can seem to stop this ram. And you'll notice in the description, it's an odd ram because it has two horns that don't seem to be of equal length, which I'm not an expert on rams, but generally the two horns grow at the same length of time, right? They look the same. They're mirrored images of each other. But verse 20 tells us what this is all about. So rather than guess, let's just look and see what the Bible says. Verse 20, the ram that you saw, Daniel, with two horns, these are the kings of Media and Persia. That was so easy. Now we know. It's not some future king. It's not something 10,000 years in the future. It is the kings of the Medes and the Persians. The Medes and the Persians were a combined nation of two nations that basically took over the world, which is why you have one horn that's bigger than the other. Because the Medes were relatively insignificant, the Persians were greater, they combine, make one nation. It is seen in a ram, and there's your Medes and Persian. King Cyrus led this nation at the beginning. The nation ruled for nearly 200 years, from 539 BC to 330 BC. We know also from history that the Persians, when they would go into battle, would carry the head of a golden ram before the army as they advance into war. That's why I think God intentionally represents them by a ram. Now, what's happening here is this nation, the Medes and the Persians, are invincible. No one can stop them. And of course, this is the nation that will ultimately bring Babylon to defeat. They will bring Babylon from the height of its power and destroy them. And I wonder if Belshazzar knows of this vision. Because if you remember in chapter 5, which would happen after this event, he is in a drunken rage. Because I think he knows the end is near. I think he knows that his tenure as king of Babylon is going to end. But I also think that it helps explain why Daniel is so confident when he goes in to see Belshazzar. He goes into that room and he sees the handwriting of the wall, that miraculous handwriting, and without hesitation, without fear, without any concern for what Belshazzar might do to him, Daniel says, "Your kingdom has ended." Why? Because Daniel knows it's ending. And he knows exactly who's going to do it. And so when they see the Medes and the Persians start to round themselves up around Babylon, they know that the prophecy of God is coming to completion. This prophecy, this knowledge gives Daniel confidence. It gives him boldness to speak the truth, to be clear. Look at verse 5. As I was considering, so as he's thinking about this ram, as he's looking at it, he's mesmerized by it, Then all of a sudden, a male goat came from the west across the face of the whole earth without touching the ground. The goat had a conspicuous horn between his eyes. And he came to the ram with two horns, which I had seen standing on the bank of the canal, and he ran at him in his powerful wrath. I saw him come close to the ram, and he was enraged against him and struck the ram and broke his two horns. The ram had no power to stand before him, but he cast him down to the ground and trampled on him. There was no one who could rescue the ram from his power. When the goat became exceedingly great, but when he was strong, the great horn was broken, and instead of it here, there came up four conspicuous horns toward the four winds of heaven. Now, generally speaking, goats are relatively smaller than rams, right? But here you have this goat that comes up in this vision while Daniel's thinking about the ram, and the goat seems just as unstoppable. He conquers the whole earth as well. And this goat equally has an odd horn. He has one. And this one horn is right between his eyes, which is not normal. If you found a goat like that, you'd probably run from that. You'd go, I think they were drinking too much water from Brookhaven Lab or something. Like, you would not want to be around that goat. The goat comes to the ram, and he breaks off both of the ram's horns. And so the ram now has no power because the ram's power is in his horns. Well, if you don't have any horns, you don't have any power. So he's now defeating him. And then the goat has his horn, his peak of his strength, broken off. But then four new horns come out of it. There's just horns going everywhere. We might be going, well, what does all this mean? Well, again, thank you, Daniel. He writes down exactly what this vision means. There's no ambiguity to what he's talking about. He says in verse 21, the goat is the king of Greece. The great horn between his eyes is the first king. As for the horn that was broken in place of which the four others arose, four kingdoms shall arise from this nation, but not with his power. The goat represents Alexander the Great. Alexander the Great in Greece, who conquers the Medo-Persian Empire in 330 BC and rules until 63 BC. And he swiftly conquers the world like without his feet even touching the ground. He's so fast. And he's prominent. At the end of World War I, after Germany was defeated, Germany was a very large nation back then, after they were defeated, the Treaty of Versailles basically crushed the German nation. They divided up everything into parts. They cut everything off. They took away their military. They took away their pride. They had nothing left. That they were demoralized and embarrassed in defeat and in the treaty. So much so that the environment that was cultivated by this crushing defeat is what made the rise of Hitler so likely, because he fed into this idea of nationalism, he fed into this idea of Germany, of needing to be great again, that they were able to rise up out of the ashes of World War I, even after they've been soundly defeated, and try again. Well, the same kind of thing seems to happen here with Greece. It says that the goat was in a fit of rage, and that accurately describes Alexander's personality. You see, the nation of Greece had been invaded years earlier by other nations, and Greece was bitter over that embarrassment. They were bitter over being defeated, and so what do? They took it out on everybody else. They beat everybody into the ground as they would go from east to west to north to south. They crushed everybody. And that fit of rage also accurately describes Alexander as a person, because he was a person who lived in rage. His father was murdered. He hated his enemies. He was willing to do anything to crush them. And he was also a little bit of an egomaniac, because he believed that he was a son of the Greek gods, that he was divine. And this, along with his military expertise, allowed him to just run roughshod through the entire world at that time. I want you to consider for a second, some of you may have to remember a little farther back than others. I want you to think back to when you were 30 years old. And if you're not 30, just think ahead to what it might look like one day to be 30. When I was 30, I had three kids. I had been married about 8 years. I was a graduate from college. I was a youth pastor. That was what I was like in 30. Nothing great. Just there was my life. Some of you at the age of 30, you were at the height of your career. Some of you are trying to find a second career by choice or not by choice. So some of you at the age of 30 were trying to buy your first house. And some of you at the age of 30 were still living in your mother's house. Some of you at the age of 30 were married and had kids. And some of you were still hoping to get married. Most of us don't accomplish a whole lot by the age of 30. At the age of 30, though, Alexander the Great was the king of the world. Literally, Leonardo DiCaprio. He was the king of the world. He ruled everything. Nobody could stop him. And then, at the height of his power, with nothing but the future ahead of him and visions of grandeur of conquering whatever else he could find, his reign ended. Now, it did not end under brutal defeat. It did not end because of insurrection. It ended because he caught a fever. And he went to bed, and he never woke up. Everything that he'd accomplished up to that point amounted to nothing. Everything that he had planned, all the dreams that he had, came to nothing. He was dead. His kingdom was in disarray. He had two sons, but his two sons had been murdered earlier. He had no heir to his throne. This prominent horn of Greece amounts to nothing. And so out of that horn grew four horns, and those four horns were four rulers, because the nation of Greece was essentially subdivided into little communities with four rulers that were the generals from the Greek army, and they ruled essentially one nation, but in four parts for the rest of the reign of Greece. But the verse then continues to talk about one of these horns, one of these four horns that arises in verse 9. It says, out of one of them came a little horn, who grew exceedingly great towards the south, towards the east, and towards the glorious land. It grew great even to the host of heaven. Some of the hosts and some of the stars it threw down to the ground and trampled on them. It became great, even as great as the prince of the host. And the regular burnt offering was taken away from him, and the place of his sanctuary was overthrown. A host will be given over to it together with the regular burnt offering because of transgression, and it will throw truth to the ground, and it will act and prosper. Now this goat is looking really odd. You have another little horn grow out of the four. One of the rulers down the line. This horn was great. It says, even against the stars of heaven, throwing them down, even as great as the prince of the host. He even took away sacrifices. He overthrew the temple. Who is this man? Well, Daniel, unfortunately, doesn't give us as much information as he has so far, but he gives a little bit. And this is what he says. At the latter end of their kingdom, talking about Greece, when the transgressors have reached their limit, talking about Israel, a king of bold face, one who understands riddles, shall arise. His power shall be great, but not by his own power. And he shall cause fearful destruction and shall succeed in what he does and destroy mighty men and the people who are the saints. But his cunning he shall make deceit prosper under his hand. And in his own mind he shall become great. Without warning he shall destroy many. Well, just to be clear, this king is not traveling into outer space conquering stars. The stars appear to be related to the glorious land. The glorious land is Israel. The stars are the Jewish people. He tramples over them. He throws them down. The prince of the host is God. He's the king of the people. He's the one that he's trampling them, but he's actually attacking the prince of the host. And we know from history exactly who this person is. Because around 175 BC, 173 BC, a man by the name of Antiochus IV, Epiphanes, emerged out of one of these kingdoms, and he began to particularly ruthlessly rule and oppress the people of Israel, the glorious land. On multiple occasions, he even opposed the obedience to the law of God. If you were a woman who wanted to obey the law of God and have your son circumcised on the eighth day, and you had them circumcised, he would have you killed. If you were a good Jewish person and you tried to honor the Sabbath by keeping it holy, he would have you killed. He would kill young, he would kill old, he would kill infants. He was ruthless. Epiphanes had an insignificant beginning. He came out as a small little horn. He was nothing. He didn't amount to a lot of power. He didn't gain the power on his own, but he was an arrogant king. Even his name suggests that Epiphanes is like the appearance of a god. He's saying, I'm a god. And he asserted himself against the people of God, the people of the host, the stars of heaven. He opposes them, but then he also opposes God himself. On his coins in which he printed, he had the name printed Theo Epiphanes, meaning God manifest. He was saying he was the representative of God to the people. Talk about arrogant. After being humiliated on one occasion in Egypt, people said that he was defeated. He wasn't defeated. He went back to Israel. He desecrated the law of God. He killed 80,000 men, women, and children. He burned the law. He erected an altar to Zeus in the temple, and then he offered a pig sacrifice on the altar to God. It desecrated the temple. He just desecrated everything that they had stood for, everything that God had instructed them. He mercilessly oppressed the people by assassinating the high priests. This vision wasn't really terrifying at first, but now all of a sudden it's starting to get terrifying. He's talking about great oppression to the people of God, desecrating the temple, opposing God, hating the law of God. This is now a very ugly scene. And at this point, two angelic beings begin to talk to one another. They begin to have conversation. Verse 13 says, I heard a holy one speaking, and another holy one said to the one who spoke, how long is the vision? Much like my kids, the angel asked them the question. We see what's going on. We see what's happening. Daniel looks a little nervous. How long is all this going to take place? Because we're sitting right now at the upper half of 500 BC. We know that Antiochus doesn't come onto the scene until 170 BC. That is 330 long years. How long is this going to take place? How long will he make the transgression that makes it desolate? How long will he give over the sanctuary? How long will he trample on the host? And then he says in verse 14, 2300 evenings and mornings. And then the sanctuary shall be restored to its rightful state. He shall even rise up against the prince of princes, and he shall be broken, but not by human hand. The vision of the evenings and the mornings that has been told is true, but seal up the vision, for it refers to many days from now. How long is this going to take place, what the angel asks? I think he's asking it preemptively for Daniel, because Daniel's probably one of the same thing. How long again? How long are we going to be oppressed? How long are people going to attack us? How long is God going to be defiled? How long is this going to take place? And if you notice, he says in the passage that the reason it's going to take place, the reason Antiochus arises to power is because of Israel's sin. Israel is going to live in sin. God is going to raise up Antiochus Epiphanes, and God is going to judge them for their sin. He's going to judge them. But how long will it last, they want to know? How long will this king rise up against God? How long will he rise up against his people? How long will he defile the temple? And Daniel is told 2,300 evenings and mornings until the sanctuary is rebuilt to its rightful state. 2,300 evenings and mornings. The question then becomes, what does that mean? Because if you know we have 2,300 evenings and mornings later, we have this same kind of thing talked about later. What does all this mean? How do we understand this? Well, there's four, I think, basic thoughts here. And the first one is that the 2,300 evenings and mornings refer to the evening and morning sacrifices of the nation of Israel. There are two a day, which means of the 2,300 sacrifices, that would be 1,150 days, which is 3.5 years, which is, as you know, is symbolic to what we see in the book of Revelation. We also see it in chapter 7. 3.5 years of persecution. And that's possible to be the answer, but so far Daniel's not talked at all about evening and morning sacrifices. In fact, it's not even mentioned in the text. We're assuming it's in the text because it talks about evening and morning, but that's not actually there. So is it 3.5 years? Probably not. Well, some people say, well, the 2,300 evenings and mornings is actually symbolic for years. In fact, the original Seventh-day Adventists believe that this prophecy said 2,300 years, and so they believed at that point Jesus would come back 2,300 years later. 2,300 years after this was roughly 1,800 A.D. As you know, Jesus did not come back in 1,800 A.D. And so the people that followed that sort of left that little cult and formed the Seventh-day Adventist Church. Well, that's obviously not right. Another possibility And I think the most likely is the evenings and mornings, if you go all the way back to Genesis chapter 1, is how God described a day. Evening and morning, day 1. Evening and morning, day 2. Evening and morning, day 3. And when he says 2,300 evenings and mornings, I think he's talking about 2,300 days. And 2,300 days is roughly 6.5 years. 6.5 years is about how long he's saying that this will last. The other option, and it's also a possible option, is that the 2,300 days is a symbolic round number. It's not meant to be taken literally. It's meant to be taken figuratively under the idea of 6.5 years, meaning it's just sort of 7. This ruler will rule for just short of a perfect period of time, and then he will be judged. I think either of option 3 or 4 makes a lot of sense. You can pick whatever option you want, but I'm sticking with option 3. 2,300 days, 6.5 years, because Antiochus's desecration of the temple occurred in roughly 170 BC. And 6.5 years later, in 164 BC, a man by the name of Judas Maccabeus came in and reestablished and re-sanctified the temple. And Antiochus was defeated and taken out, and the temple was restored and sacrifices were restored in the nation of Israel. And of course, you know this because we see all of our Jewish friends celebrating Hanukkah. That is the celebration of Judas Maccabeus reestablishing the temple. 6.5 years, this will go on, this oppression. But then it will be over. Not by human hand, but God will defeat and tear down Antiochus, and he will reestablish the things that are happening. So all that to say, this chapter is not primarily talking about the future for us. It is primarily talking about the future for Daniel, which happens roughly 400 years from the time of Daniel till about 160, 150 BC. Daniel and his friends are not yet in this persecution, but they will be, and God's giving a vision saying this is what's going to happen. So the question then becomes, what does Daniel do about this? In verse 27, it says, Daniel was overcome and lay sick for some days, and then rose and went about the king's business. But I was appalled by the vision and did not understand it. What did Daniel do about it? He got sick to his stomach. He saw the persecution of the people of God. He saw the desecration of the temple of God. He saw the desecration of the law of God. He saw the opposition to God, and it made him sick to his stomach. And then you know what Daniel did? He went and hid in a house. No, he didn't do that. No, it says he went back about the king's business. He didn't go hide. He didn't go stockpile weapons and go, hey, how are we going to stop all this from happening? How are we going to fight these oppressors? He went back to serving the king. This evil king Belshazzar, he served him. Because I think more importantly, he's serving God. And he's being a light among the Gentiles for God in exile. But what does God want us to know? Why does God tell Daniel this vision? I think it's actually very simple. God wants Daniel to know two things. One, he wants him to know that the Israelite people will be judged for their sin. They're going to be judged for it. And two, he doesn't want Daniel or the people of Israel to be fearful over the oppression that they face. He doesn't want them to be scared. Why? Because we know from chapter 7 that God's kingdom will be established and reign forever. So if something happens in between now and the end of his kingdom, we don't have to be scared because we know the outcome no matter what happens in the middle. Don't be scared. So how he reminds them to be scared is he reminds them of a couple of things. He says first, God is sovereign over history. Who else can give this detailed of an explanation of what's going to happen 400 years in advance? Only God can. Why? Because only God controls the future. God's sovereign. So why are we worrying about the future? Why are we worrying about what's going to happen, the oppression? God's sovereign. Just trust him. He will take care of it. But second, God also is sovereign over the future. He's also more powerful than his enemies. Alexander the Great is the greatest ruler of his time. And he disappears off the face of the earth because of a fever. That's not coincidence. That's God. Antiochus Epiphanes Israel is given into his hand. That's not because he's great, that's because of God. He's going to be torn down, not by human hands. That's not because Israel's great. It's because of God. God has power over the enemies. And I love the way that God describes the enemies here. Because in chapter 7, they're ferocious beasts. Some of them are too scary to even describe. In chapter 8, they're a bunch of barnyard animals. God goes, don't be scared of these people. They're rams and goats. Do you know what Jewish people do to rams and goats? They slit their throats and they put them on an altar and sacrifice them. These are not scary animals. God goes, don't be afraid of them. And finally, he reminds them that an attack on the people of God is an attack on God because God's with his people. God's with his people. So if the people of God are attacked, then God's attacked, and God will get justice. You don't need to worry about it. You don't need to get vengeance. You don't need to get justice, he says. You just keep trusting in me, and I will get you to the finish line because I'm with my people. Now, of course, at the end of 164 BC, the temple is restored and sacrifices are resumed. But we know that that's not the end of the story, because there's going to come another day in the future with one that is greater than Judas Maccabeus, as great as he was. He is actually going to come into the earth, and he is going to restore not just a physical temple, he's going to restore a spiritual temple of all of God's people. And he is not going to come in and just reestablish sacrifices for a time. He's going to come in and be sacrifice, the final sacrifice, and end all sacrifices, because there's no more sacrifice to come. He's going to come in not as just the light of Hanukkah for a couple of days. He's going to come in as the light of the world who's going to rule forever. Jesus is going to come and be born and face people like Antiochus Epiphanes, who are going to oppose him, who are going to defame the temple, who are going to desecrate the law of God. And Jesus is going to suffer and die for the sins of many. Some of you are not that much different than Israel. You're not that much different from Belshazzar, and you're not that much different from Antiochus Epiphanes, because you have lived your life dishonoring God, desecrating his temple, dishonoring his law, and living in sin for your own glory and purposes. You may not call yourself a God, but you live and you function exactly like that. And the warning from Daniel is that sin will be judged, whether you are Jewish or whether you are a wicked Gentile ruler and everybody in between. God will judge you for your sin. The only question is will you pay for your sin, or will your sin be judged in Jesus? Because all those who trust in Jesus, who trust in the life that he lived, in the perfect life he established for us, and who trust in the death that he lived on our behalf, if you trust in that, then the judgment of God for your sin falls on him. If you trust in yourself, the judgment of God falls on you. And so the invitation of the gospel is not trust in Jesus plus what I can do, trust in Jesus plus coming to church, or trust in Jesus plus all of these religious activities I do. If you trust in Jesus plus anything, then you will pay for your sin. If you trust in Jesus plus nothing, then he pays for your sin. And he invites you to trust in him no matter who you are today, whether you're the worst of sinner or whether you are the most righteous of sinners, and to trust in Jesus and to find forgiveness and rescue from your judgment. Some of you, like Daniel, like the people of Israel, might be tempted to live in fear. You might be tempted to live in fear of what is happening around you, of the circumstances of your life that you cannot control. You look at evil forces that are out there. You look at terrorists. You look at what's happening in the election. Who's going to be the next most powerful man in the world? Or maybe you fear things on a much smaller scale. You fear what's going to happen in the next 5 years of your life. You fear whether or not you're ever going to find the right person. You fear whether or not you will outlive your children, or whether or not the heart disease that is in your family line will somehow take your life too. You live in fear of all of these things. And these fears can overwhelm you. And the message of Daniel is that there is nothing to fear because God is in control of the big history. He's in control of your history. God has power over the greatest of enemies. He has power over the smallest of enemies in your life. And he says, don't fear. Why are you fearing all of these things? They're a drop in the bucket. They're a vapor. They're a mist. They're nothing. The president is not the most powerful man in the world. Jesus is. Terrorists don't have the most power in the world. Jesus does. Your genetic history does not dictate your future. Jesus does. If that's true of Jesus, and if you're a follower of Jesus, then why are you fearing anything? Whatever fills you with fear, whatever causes you to stay up at night, whatever gives you bad dreams and visions, know that God is more powerful than all of it. And we know that the worst of our fears, even the worst things that you couldn't even imagine that could ever happen to you, that none of those things, Paul says, nothing, none of it can ever separate you from the love of God which is in Christ Jesus. It can't do it. So why are we afraid? God doesn't want you to be afraid. He wants you to trust him. He goes, I have the future. I know your future. I know the plans I have for you. I know everything. Why are you afraid? Some of you read things of prophecy and you get so bent out of shape and so neurotic about the future that you spend all of your time planning so that bad things don't happen to you. Well, I read in the book of Revelation there's going to be a war, so I better stockpile weapons and water and canned food and a non-electric can opener so I can feed myself and protect my family, or we're all going to die. Listen, Daniel hears what's going to happen in the future, and what does he do? He goes about his business. Why? Because he trusts who's in control. You know who's in control. So you don't need to be fearful about what's happening now or what might happen in the future or what might happen 10,000 years down the road. You know who holds the future. So what does God want for you to do? He wants you to go about your business. He wants you to go about the business of serving the king. Not an evil king like Daniel had to serve, but a righteous, good king who loves you. To serve him, to do his bidding, to be the best worker you can be in your job because you know who holds the future. To be the best parent you can in your household because you know who holds the future. To be the best student in your classroom because you know who holds the future. God wants you to live for his purposes and for his glory. Some of you see and hear the oppression of God's people, maybe on the news, maybe on Facebook. And you become desensitized to it. Like we see the oppression of God's people in China and we like it with a smiley face on Facebook. Like, that's really spiritual. Hey, look, I liked it. I'm doing something for the world. You become so desensitized, you don't even realize it. The oppression of God's people should make you sick to your stomach. The desecration of God's law in our society and the world should make you sick to your stomach, not laugh. Seeing people trying to usurp God from his throne, a faultless try nonetheless, but an attempt, shouldn't make you smile and laugh. It should make you disgusted. But we've become so desensitized, we don't even care. People in China are losing their heads for the sake of Christ, while you and I debate about whether or not we have enough hot water, or whether or not our Whopper was made correctly. Or we start planning about the third or fourth car we're going to buy. Or how our house is insignificantly small when in reality it's bigger than 90% of the houses in all the world. We're just so tunneled that we don't see anything beyond ourselves. And yet the people of God are being oppressed. God goes, don't you care about my people? And sadly, some of you are the oppressors of God's people, which is ironic because you are one of God's people. At least you say you are. And then you're the oppressor of God's people. You lie about, gossip about, cheat, steal from, slander God's people. And notice what it said in Daniel. When Antiochus Epiphanes persecuted God's people, who did he persecute? God. When you attack the people in this room, you're not attacking a name and a face in this room. You are attacking the King of Heaven. Stew that around the next time you think about hurting someone. That's who you're attacking. And you know what God always gets for his people? He always gets justice. I mean, as a warning, I would not want to be on the wrong side of the justice. It should break your heart when the people in this room suffer physically. When they suffer because of the attacks of lost people. When they suffer because of attacks of fellow Christians. We have people in our church suffering right now. Right? Felix Cabrera suffering at home, dying of brain cancer. It should break your heart. You should want to go sit with him. You should want to go talk with him. You should go pray for him. Thomas Fiorentino usually sits in the wheelchair about halfway back. He almost died 2 weeks ago. Got stuck in a chair. Couldn't get out of it. And now he's in the ICU at St. Charles. People are suffering. Does it break your heart? Does it make you sick? Or do you just turn back on the TV and go, yep, great, people are suffering. Pass me the donuts. Does it break your heart? God's encouraging the church, and he wants us to know that he will gain victory. There will be oppression, there will be evil forces, and there will be evil forces all on the way who will take on the appearance of Antiochus Epiphanes, and there will be people after him that John calls the Antichrist that will continue to just oppress and oppress and oppress the people of God. Jesus says in Matthew chapter 24 that there will be one, referring to Daniel chapter 7 and 8, who will come like the man of lawlessness like this, who will defile God, who will dishonor the temple, and who will attack the people of God. And this will happen throughout the generations. It'll happen all the time. And we know that will happen, Jesus says, all the way to the time that he comes back, because he will not come back until the Antichrist has established himself. One who opposes God, one who hates the law of God, one who hates the people of God, one who props himself up as God. But we don't need to fear those things. You don't need to fear who the Antichrist is or when he'll come and how long he'll reign. You don't need to fear whether it's 7 days or 7 years or 6 and a half or 3 and a half years. Or you don't need to fear any of that. Because Jesus has told us he has already won. He has told us that evil will have its day, but its day is short. He will tell us that evil will have its time, but the time is soon ending. He has told us not to be fearful. There is a war that is raging on around you, and you must be aware of the war. But you do not need to be afraid of the war, because the war is secure. God has already won through the cross of Jesus. God has already claimed his people for his own. He cannot be stopped. His enemies will not be able to overpower him. They will not win. And God is with his people right now, that even as we walk through these days, we know that God is in us, and wherever we are, he is, because we are his temple and we are the people of God. And he will fight for us, and he will rescue us, and he will save us until the day that Jesus Christ appears on a horizon as the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords, and he brings a swift and final judgment, not with violence, but with a word, and his enemies will cower in defeat because he has won, and there will be nothing left to fear. That's good news. Let's pray.